KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. New Mexico went into lockdown on Monday, a shelter-in-place order. Non-essential businesses closed, and a lot of people are worried. Mobile morgues that made the national news in El Paso are now in Las Cruces as well, at Memorial Hospital and Mountain View Medical Center. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Memorial Medical Center in Las Cruces is working to keep up with the recent increase of COVID-19 cases. According to Chief Medical Officer Dolores Gomez, the hospital could reach capacity in the next few weeks if current trends continue.
We stay on our trajectory of where we are. We could be looking at hitting a point where we have to worry about capacity issues within the next 1 to 3 weeks. But it's hard to say, and it's all going to depend how sick somebody gets. We're continuing to see the number of positive cases continue to go up. You know, when you see those numbers go up, you know that some of those people are going to be at our doorstep here at the hospital.
Gomez is part of a team made up of hospital nurses, engineers, and other staff that monitors the COVID situation on a daily basis. She says that care will continue, even if the facility reaches full capacity.
You're not going to stop caring for patients. You know, if you're working in the hallways or you're working in areas that aren't normally patient care areas, we're going to build that capacity. Maybe it's just done in a different facility with maybe not as severe as a sickness in those patients as well. So we're working with our community, working with our city and our county to look at that as well. We don't ever want to say we can't give you care.
As part of the hospital's emergency preparedness plan, Memorial Medical Center currently has a mobile morgue to compensate for lack of space inside the hospital.
Unfortunately, the part that we have to prepare is having that ability to place for them if they pass away until they can get their final resting place. And so the morgue that's been brought in for MMC is one. Mountain View also has two available. If it needs to go to more than that, then that's what we have to do. But at this point, that's kind of where we're sitting right now in our emergency preparedness plan.
In nearby El Paso, where hospitals are already reaching capacity, one traveling nurse took to Facebook Live to describe her experience working at the University Medical Center of El Paso. Liana Rivers recounted her experience working with the sickest patients in the hospital.
I was put in what's called a pit, and in this pit was 8 patients, all COVID positive. My first day of orientation, I was told that whatever patients go into the pit, they only come out in a body bag.
Texas accounts for more than 1 million of the total number of cases in the United States, which now sits at over 11 million. Here in Las Cruces, Gomez says Memorial Medical Center is working to make sure their emergency preparedness plan covers a multitude of different scenarios.
I think just definitely being prepared and being ready for the possibility. I think you always want to look for that worst case scenario, and then you hope that you don't get there, but you want to be prepared for that as much as possible.
Gomez emphasized that the best way the public can help is to follow the governor's shelter-in-place order, wear masks, and practice social distancing.
This is a public health issue. It is not anything more than that. It's real. It's scary. It's hard for us to have to make these sacrifices that we're making to not be with those that we love or not be able to celebrate some party or wedding or whatever it is. But it's the way that we're going to get through this. And until we really look at that and say, this is what we need to do, when we do that, we'll be able to get back where we need to be, but we need everybody to be on board right now more than ever, just because of what we're seeing in the numbers.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
The courts overturned a lockdown in El Paso County, and health workers are furious. More than 1,100 COVID patients are hospitalized in El Paso. The situation is so bad that even patients who don't have COVID are being turned away, sent to hospitals elsewhere in the state of Texas. Nurses took to the streets in a caravan to urge people to stay home. KTEP's Angela Cocherga has more from the Hunkathon.
The nurses caravan through downtown El Paso Monday evening, honking their horns. Their message, stay home. They circled brightly lit San Jacinto Plaza, decorated for Christmas, with signs that read, "Stay Home." A fire truck from Laredo and an emergency vehicle from Mission were part of the caravan. The nurses urged El Pasoans to protect themselves and healthcare workers during a deadly surge in COVID cases that has overwhelmed hospitals. In a statement issued earlier in the day by the nurses' organization, they said they are deeply concerned an appeals court struck down a stay-home order issued by the county judge. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
One bright spot this week in Texas and around the country, the state of Texas began distributing a new COVID-19 therapy this week to high-risk patients across the state. As KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, the therapy is designed to prevent some serious complications of the virus.
It's called bamlanivimab, and initial shipments of this antibody drug are expected to reach hospitals across Texas beginning this week. It may not be easy to pronounce, says Chris Van Dusen with the State Health Department, and it's not a cure.
It's one dose is the whole treatment course. And it's an infusion, so it's an outpatient medication. It's not for people who are in the hospital. Hopefully you want to catch them early in the course of the disease before it is very severe. And what it's been shown to do is prevent hospitalizations in people who are at a greater risk of hospitalizations.
Texas and Illinois are getting the most doses, about 6,000, and distribution will be based on new lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in communities and in hospitals. And it'll be free. COVID-19's been rising steadily in Texas, recording more than a million cases here and more than 19,000 confirmed deaths since March. I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
This week, Mexico passed 1 million confirmed COVID cases. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, KJZZ's Murphy Woodhouse reports.
That grim milestone comes as the country is also approaching 100,000 confirmed deaths, according to federal data. Prevention and Health Promotion Subsecretary Hugo López-Gatell.
Ayer, los medios de comunicación siguieron destacando el tema de los casos acumulados.
He says the media was focusing heavily on the million figure, but that it provided a limited view of the situation. He noted that with suspected cases, the number already well exceeds 1 million. More important is the fact that the epidemic remains very active in the country. There are an estimated 47,000 active cases, according to data he presented. There has been far less testing in Mexico than other countries around the world. In Sonora, roughly 72,000 tests have been done, compared to nearly 2 million diagnostic tests in neighboring Arizona. I'm Murphy Woodhouse in Hermosillo.
In focus now, a closer look at the pandemic and why it is going out of control in the borderland. Anthony Moreno looked for answers with Dr. Armando Meza, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Texas Tech Physicians of El Paso.
My best guess on what can account for this is, number one, one of the things that we have always been concerned about and we don't really know is what percentage of patients or individuals in the population have been exposed and infected that have some immunity. In other words, the number of susceptible individuals in the community is still significant relative to the number of cases that have become infected, that have become diagnosed. And when you have a large population that still has risk for infection, the only thing you need next is a risk factor, a exposure activity that unfortunately I believe has actually been the problem that we have been facing in the last few weeks. So if populations at risk lose that ability to protect themselves from the exposure to COVID-19 virus, the infection will inevitably occur.
The federal government has largely left it up to the states to set up their own public health restrictions and requirements when it comes to COVID-19. How does it impact us navigating this crisis if every state has different rules and restrictions when it comes to stopping the spread of COVID-19?
I believe the intent of the restrictions or the ability for local governments to select or decide, it has a good intent. The only thing that we need to be careful is that, you know, we still have individuals who not necessarily have the maximum benefit of this, and probably they are affected. They can be affected financially. They can be affected emotionally. So there's always something good and something bad of taking an action. Obviously, the benefit of the population, of the community at large, is what you are really trying to prioritize when you have these measures. The disadvantage of that is that there's been, I think, a message problem that the federal government has been unable to deliver the right information, or the information that is consistently delivered in a way that people believe it. And, you know, persuasion is a very complicated art of making people believe that what they are doing is right. Sometimes we use what we call negative incentives, and usually they don't work for the long run. So we need to be more consistent in the messages. I think people believe the local authorities more than the federal government, if you put the two into perspective. And a consistent message and an open message from the local government, the local health department entities, is what the best strategy will be for any community. I think the local health department has done a very good job in that. They are keeping people informed. They are making decisions that I feel they are for the best interest of our community. But again, the always important proof is that the cases go down. When the cases don't go down, people start to doubt themselves. You start to doubt as a citizen whether, you know, we are doing enough, and we start to blame it on people. And I think that that's the wrong message we want to convey. We want to make sure that people continue to do the right measures to prevent infection, because at the end of the day, that's the only thing that is going to make this curve change, regardless of what we think about it, whether it's a good or bad action.
Dr. Armando Mesa is Chief of Infectious Diseases at Texas Tech Physicians of El Paso. Dr. Mesa, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, COVID-19 is a reminder that Republicans still have a very big challenge when it comes to health care policy. They didn't present an alternative to the Affordable Care Act, and it may have hurt them at the polls. It certainly did in 2018. Some thoughts now from commentator Walt Rubel.
I was originally not going to include Libertarian candidate Bob Walsh in the U.S. Senate election interviews we conducted recently on community radio, but my co-host Peter Goodman argued that if Walsh was on the ballot, he needed to be invited. I'm glad he did, as Walsh provided my favorite moment of all the campaign interviews this year. I asked him about the government's role in healthcare, and I put it in the most basic terms I could think of. I have no money. I have no insurance. I get in a car crash. What should happen? Well, you're going to be broke, he said. I'm already broke. My question is, should they send an ambulance and take me to the hospital, or should they let me bleed to death in the streets? After a long pause, he replied, "For one thing, you've been totally irresponsible for not having money and not having insurance." There was no second thing. That was it. Maybe some good-hearted person will stop and help. Maybe not. I suspect the government would at least be allowed to drag me to the side of the road so as to avoid a traffic hazard. Of all the answers given by all the candidates this year in both the primary and general election, that one might have been the most honest. Walsh could afford to be honest, given the impossibility of his potential victory. Republicans can't afford to be that honest. And to be clear, I don't believe they share Walsh's view that emergency services should be reserved for those who can afford them. But on the issue of health care, they don't have a better answer than he does. For the past 10 years, the GOP has been united in its opposition to the Affordable Care Act, but divided on what should replace it. That's why former Senator John McCain famously turned his thumb down on the final attempt by Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare. He knew, just like we all knew, that there was no replacement. Yet Republican attorneys were in the Supreme Court earlier this month, arguing once again that the health care program should be declared unconstitutional. Chief Justice John Roberts correctly noted that they're asking the court to do what they could not do in Congress. Based on the oral arguments, it appears that Republicans seeking to overturn our health care system without a replacement will once again be saved from themselves. Or, more accurately, we'll all be saved from them. The ACA was passed with no Republican votes. That's been a bitter pill that still hasn't been swallowed. They'll keep chipping at it and fighting against it forever. It's time for something new, using many of the principles of the ACA. The next healthcare plan that gets passed will be more inclusive, providing more services to more people than the one that's in place now. And that's a good thing. Republican leaders need to understand that's the goal and figure out how or if they can contribute to getting there. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's columns appear in the Local Viewpoints section at krwg.org. Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, after a tense presidential election, some Americans are facing uncomfortable conversations with loved ones about the current political climate. KERA's Saida Hassan spoke with a psychologist about how to navigate those tough discussions.
This presidential election has been a source of stress for a majority of Americans, regardless of political party. That's according to a recent survey from the American Psychological Association. Vail Wright is the group's senior director of healthcare innovation. She says it's important to set realistic expectations when talking to loved ones with different political beliefs.
It's really about approaching them with curiosity, non-judgment, not with the goal of trying to change another person's mind, because you're not going to be very effective. But if we'd enter in these conversations just trying to understand the other person's point of view, then I think we have a chance to be more effective and to bridge some of these divides that we're seeing right now in the country.
And Wright says children can pick up on the political tension, even if they don't fully grasp the issues. She says adults can use this as a teaching moment, listening to kids' concerns and using age-appropriate language to answer their questions about the election. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
Well, in the lead-up to the election and its aftermath, there has been a lot of talk about how Hispanics are not a monolith. It's also something Brandi Ruiz has been thinking about. Ruiz is a journalism student at the University of Texas at El Paso, and she filed this report.
When Gabriel Renifo was 12, his family moved from Venezuela to Denton, Texas. That's where he first learned about Hispanic Heritage Month.
That wasn't a thing growing up, you know, I'm Hispanic every month. I get it. It's here. It's the United States. Like, yeah, there's a bunch of cultures. You need a month to kind of, like, remember it.
Renifo's in college now at the University of North Texas. But back in middle school, during Hispanic Heritage Month, he was always the one selected to pick decorations for the school's announcement board, even though most of his classmates were Mexican-American. While his teachers singled him out, his classmates assumed he was like them.
Like, eventually, like, they were like, you're Mexican, right? And then I taught them, like, I'm not Mexican. Say I'm Hispanic, and then I'll tell you where I'm at, like, where I'm from, right? I was like, how do you not know that? And then I started realizing that, like, people just think of Latinos and Mexico. Because it's just the nearest thing here, right? And there's just so much more.
I have to admit, as a kid, I was that person. I grew up on the border, raised by a Mexican mom, surrounded by other Mexican Americans. But we never really learned about other Latin American countries and their cultures. We barely even learned about our own. Just a few lessons about Dia de los Muertos, maybe Cesar Chavez, and then the Mexican-American War. Taught from the U.S. point of view, of course.
You would think in El Paso you would learn so much more about Hispanic culture, but you really don't.
Kyra Lewis is a senior at UT El Paso. She says she always felt connected to her Mexican roots, not because of what she learned in school, but because of her grandmother.
My grandma is very, like, traditional Mexican woman. Like, she cooks and 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 is offended when you don't eat her food and, like, very stereotypical.
Lewis is Afro-Latina, Mexican, and Black. In some ways, she's had the opposite experience of Gabriel Renifo. People don't assume she's Mexican. They're especially shocked when they see her dance to Spanish music with her grandma.
They see a big Black woman walk in with her afro all out, and then she starts dancing. They're like, oh my God, are you Cuban? no, are you Colombian? No, you're Dominican. Like, I'm Black and Mexican. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Lewis says there's no color barrier on being Hispanic, but sometimes Afro-Latinos are erased.
Even when Afro-Latinos are represented, like, it's not really accepted as what being Hispanic is.
The word Hispanic is meant to encompass many countries and cultures. But Frank Perez, who teaches communication at UT El Paso, says it doesn't always work that way.
We tend to kind of overemphasize the Spanish side of the culture, and then we downplay the mestizo or indigenous or Mexican sides of the culture, or other parts of the Latinx culture.
Perez says the term Hispanic and the way Hispanic history is taught often ignores indigenous people and the crimes committed against them.
We create this mythic ideal, you know, that the Spaniards came and the indigenous fell to their knees and said, thank you for bringing in science and religion. And then, you know, the natives would happily wake up every morning and they would just throw corn on the ground and beanstalks would jump up. And at the end of the day, they'd sit with the friars and learn Christianity and learn to read. And that's ridiculous.
Kyra Lewis believes the push for cultural assimilation in the U.S. cuts Latinos off from our roots.
There's really no one box to put Hispanic people in. And I think that's what's really beautiful about having cultures outside of like an American culture.
She thinks we should reclaim those roots and recognize there's no single definition of Hispanic or Latino. As for Gabriel Renifo, who moved to the U.S. in middle school.
I would say I'm Hispanic, but I'm just Venezuelan, bro.
I'm Brandy Reese in El Paso.
Some analysts say Republicans took good advantage of this issue, the fact that Hispanics are not a monolith, targeting Hispanics in Texas and Florida with fears of socialism, and also targeting Hispanic voters who are conservative on the issue of abortion rights. They know that many of them become one-issue voters. If you're against abortion rights, they'll vote for you. And it worked. It worked very well for President Trump in Florida, where he just barely won and got all the electoral votes. He had a bigger win in Texas, and part of that was also related to this dynamic, analysts say. Zapata County in South Texas made national headlines after the election. The county, get this, is more than 94% Latino, and for the first time in a century, it backed a Republican presidential candidate. Roughly 52% of its voters cast their ballots for President Donald Trump. But experts and local voters themselves were not as surprised to see Trump win across the region. Texas Public Radio's Maria Mendez has more.
There's a welcome to Zapata sign.
I drive by some mostly empty ranch land through some houses clustered along the road.
A few stores, it's pretty small.
The border county of Zapata is rural. About 14,000 people live here.
We don't have a HEB, we don't have Walmart, we don't have any big retail store.
Ricardo Ramirez is the CEO and president of the IBC Bank in Zapata.
You know, we don't have that. So everything here in Zapata is a small business, okay? And every small business depends a lot on the oil field.
A little more than 13% of working age residents work in mining, quarrying, or oil and gas extraction, according to 2018 census data. It's still one of the few work options in the county. Ramita says that's why Biden's comments resonated here during the last presidential debate.
Close down the oil. By the way, I would transition from the oil industry, yes.
And drove voters to the polls for President Donald Trump.
Will you remember that, Texas?
Texas Democrats counted on Zapata and the historically blue border counties to propel Biden. But it turns out
sometimes things are not what they appear, right?
Ramirez, who also serves as president of the school board, is like most county residents, a registered Democrat.
But there is basically no Republican Party in Zapata because everybody associates with Democrat. So our elections, our local elections, they're basically determined in the primaries.
But at the national level, Ramirez says,
so I've been voting Republican at the presidential level since 1988.
He's one of Zapata's mixed-ticket voters who defied conventional political labels even before Texas eliminated straight-ticket voting this election.
The Trump supporters were already out there.
That's Anna Holcomb. She's another Democratic Trump voter. Her family works in the oil industry, and she had already voted for Trump in 2016. Back then, she was quiet about her support, worried about offending others, but not this year. After finding a community in the Zapata Trump Train Facebook group, she and other supporters held their own Trump Train, or car caravan, in late September. Laredo and other cities in the valley also had Trump Trains, and they helped Zapata Trump supporters like Holcomb.
And they helped us get signs and information on how to get a billboard and things like that, since we don't have a Republican Party in Zapata.
It's that grassroots work that helped Trump make inroads along the Rio Grande, according to Henry Flores, a political scientist at St. Mary's School of Law.
The Republican Party had a really energetic ground game going on down there because there'd been a couple of counties that had seemed to be on the verge of developing some strong local Republican organizations. And I think what they did was just kept feeding it. And it bore fruit in both Zapata and La Salle.
Trump also flipped La Salle, and he also increased his support in other border counties. Silvia Cervantes is one of the Democratic voters Trump picked up in Laredo in 2016. She expected her husband, Genaro, to vote for Biden.
But I said, did you vote after all? Dijo, I mailed it. Dije, okay. Dije, can you tell me who you voted? Dijo, yeah, I voted for Trump, Silvia.
Genaro, a veteran, told her it was because he feared national Democrats are moving towards socialism.
He's a soldier. So se cambió por esa única razón. Cuando eres un soldado y te arriesga tu vida a estar peleando for our freedom, nobody wants socialism.
Back in Zapata County.
Nice to meet you. I'm Maria Mendez.
Nice to meet you, Maria.
Trump supporters like Yvette de Leon find it increasingly hard to support the Democratic Party.
And we're a small town, and like everybody says, we're one of the poorest counties in Texas and everything. And that's really sad that people are okay with that. I mean, it's sad that people want to keep voting Democrat so we can continue being one of the poorest counties in Texas. I mean, does that make sense? It doesn't make sense.
Though Democrats are known for championing social programs, De Leon says people want jobs. But she didn't see Biden's plans to transition from fossil fuels as realistic.
And nobody tries to get any kind of commerce, any kind of, you know, something going here on the border where people can go to work instead of living off of all the free stuff.
Others like Isela Gonzalez Lindquist, a saleswoman at a Laredo mattress store, were drawn to Trump and Republicans because of their Christian or Catholic ideals.
So I think me being a mom of three and a wife and a Christian and a very family-oriented person, I'm pro-life. Those are the issues that matter the most to me. And, you know, he's unashamed to support the Christian community.
But they warn that they don't agree with everything Trump and the Republican Party promote. Lindquist, for example, says she supports gay rights, and like many people in Zapata, she doesn't think Trump's border wall is needed. The county itself is suing the Trump administration.
Like I told a friend of mine, you know, he's not my friend. He's my president. You know, I wouldn't choose to be friends with a guy like that. But I like what he brings to the table. I like that he represents strength. He doesn't let down. He's got grit.
Lindquist sees the opportunity for more Republican representation.
My little girl is a sophomore in high school, and she's got a classmate who has the goal, the dream and the goal of running as a Republican for office in Zapata. So we'll wait to see. I foresee some young Republicans in our near future.
Latino Trump supporters like Yvette de Leon don't want to be taken for granted anymore.
I heard that Biden, they're claiming that he's the president now, and which I'm fully willing to accept it. If that's God's will, that's God's will. And, you know, no hate towards anybody or anything. But, you know, I hope that they notice. I hope that they notice that we need a difference in Zapata. Zapata needs something different.
I'm Maria Mendez in Zapata.
More reaction to the election now. College Democrats and Republicans are looking to the future following this month's election. KRWG public media intern Xavier Dominguez reports.
Isaiah Torres of the New Mexico State University College Democrats says he's encouraged by the increase in voter turnout and President-elect Joe Biden's victory.
This just really shows that, like, Americans now really do care about politics and how politics could play in their lives. And I have a lot of expectations from the Biden-Kamala Harris administration.
President Donald Trump acknowledged Biden's victory in a tweet saying, quote, "He won, but Trump refuses to concede." Edward Kilroy is the vice chair of the NMSU College Republicans, and like Trump, he says he does not accept the results.
I think we'll just have to wait and see basically on what happens with all the votes and the way that it's structured for our voting process and what happens with the election as a whole.
While many Republicans continue to dispute the election results, Torres is optimistic about the future of the Biden-Harris administration.
I feel like Joe Biden's really going to do is just bring us together when during this time of this tragedy.
The Cybersecurity and the Infrastructure Security Agency disputes Trump's statements and echoed repeated assertions by election experts and state officials. In a report saying this year's election was the most secure ever, the agency said, quote, "There is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised." Torres worries about how Trump's actions might undermine our democracy.
There has not been evidence yet. There are claims that there has been voter fraud in certain places, but they were kind of renounced. But this is very worrisome for me because he is really undermining the integrity and the legitimacy of our election.
There were some bright spots for Republicans. Democrats lost seats in the House, including New Mexico's 2nd District Congressional seat, with incumbent Xochitl Torres Small being defeated by Yvette Harrell. Torres says he wishes her well.
I expect Yvette Harrell to do her job and try to represent District 2 as best as possible. And I'm wishing her the best of luck and just trust that she makes the right decisions and has a good heart when she's making those decisions as well.
Edward Kilroy worked on Harrell's campaign during the summer and is excited to see what she brings to the next Congress.
I think it's important for some of the kind of kangaroo bills that they put forth against our Second Amendment right. So I think Yvette will stand strong for that, as well as our energy here in New Mexico. I think she'll be a great representative.
Kilroy is pro-gun and advocates for freedom of expression, but he adds that there is a need for unity.
I would like to see us become more unified and realize that we can have differences of opinion. However, that doesn't mean that you're a good or bad person or politics aren't so divisive in terms of lifestyle or people. It's just a difference of opinion.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Xavier Dominguez.
Voters young and old have heard this over and over again. Red and blue states, Republican and Democratic voters. And the use of the term conservative when it really should be Republican. Well, this jargon, you know, some folks say it's really kind of meaningless. In fact, if you look at the results, we're much more of a purple nation. That's because, of course, people vote, not masses of land, where all of the votes are given to one presidential candidate, even if the margin is razor thin. Someone is talking about this, and we talked with him, a New Mexico State University law professor in the College of Business, Dwight Keeley. Dwight, tell me how you became interested in this topic, which I think is really important. Most would agree it's a misrepresentation to call a state red or blue when there are such small differences in the overall vote.
I think I've always been interested in color in general. And I remember seeing a map in the 2016 election, and it showed all the states as either red or blue. But when you looked at the popular vote for each state, you would find that a red state might have voted 55% red and 45% blue. And the opposite was true for the blue state. It just dawned on me that if you see a color that is 55% red and 45% blue, you wouldn't call it red, you wouldn't call it blue, you would call it purple. And of course, the same is true for the blue states that is really 45% red. If you're 55% blue and 45% red, you're purple.
Absolutely. And you show that in your own map, which is very purple all across the country. And, you know, some noticed this year on the major media organizations that do red and blue that red Nebraska had some blue spots. And many people didn't realize that Nebraska and Maine are the only two states that allocate two electoral votes to the statewide winner, but then they allow each congressional district to award one electoral vote to the popular vote winner in their specific district. What do you make of this idea?
Yes, I think that's really interesting when you look at that, and a great attempt for these states to acknowledge that even states as solidly red as Nebraska may not be accurately depicted in an all-or-nothing red or blue vote. Now, you've probably heard some arguments where some people, usually from a blue perspective, have said we should abolish the Electoral College and just have the national popular vote decide the presidency. Of course, on the other side, usually from a red perspective, there's been arguments against this, saying that this would give too much power to the more populous blue states. I think by allocating an Electoral College vote to individual congressional districts, Nebraska and Maine are giving a voice to the minority in an otherwise red or blue state. If Texas did this, the otherwise red state would have some blue spots. If California did this, you'd see some red. Now, I should also say I'm not a political scientist, and I have not researched the merits of the fairness of the various alternatives. My interest was just to show that our nation, like most of us, are more purple than our maps would suggest.
Absolutely. Of course, another danger of using the term red or blue state is that it implies political philosophy, when in fact, the truth is a lot more complicated. And there's many examples of this, but I'll just give one from this month's election. About 51% of people in Florida chose Trump for president. But 61% of folks in Florida voted for a $15 minimum wage, a policy almost universally derided by Republicans. So really important to understand.
Exactly. And maybe that's another way of explaining this purple map. When you really look at the parties or ourselves, the red isn't always that red, and the blue isn't always that blue. Maybe some are, but often when we find people who don't like, for example, the Affordable Care Act, they tend to appreciate that their child isn't excluded from health insurance because of a pre-existing condition. Or the candidate who might win fighting socialism will lose on a platform that even threatens Social Security.
Absolutely. So important to understand. And there are many, as I said, many examples of this all over the country where when people get a chance to vote on issues, even in states that the major media outlets call red, they vote for policies that are associated with blue, with Democrats. Another one that was a big one this year was there were a number of states that individuals voted to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, even though their Republican legislatures were against that. When it went to a vote of the people chose that. So very interesting. Other thoughts, Dwight, on seeing accurate colors, if you will, when thinking about politics?
I'll just share something that I've tried to apply in my life that I heard a long time ago that I try to challenge myself. And it's this. I try to resist the idea that those who disagree with me must be stupid or evil. And that might sound extreme, but I think we often do this, and we just need to remember sometimes people might just disagree with us, and it's not because they must be stupid or evil. And sometimes it's not phrased that bluntly, but you might hear something like, hey, these people think this way or vote this way. They're different because they don't understand economics or business or history, or you can fill in the blank. What we're really saying sometimes is that other person is stupid. And if only they were as smart as we were, they'd vote like us. I think sometimes we forget. Maybe they just disagree. And then on the evil side, sometimes people say, okay, maybe you're not stupid, but you must hate the United States, or you're trying to take away our freedoms, or you're trying to destroy, you know, our family, our business, or career advancement, traditions, or way of life. Well, you're not saying they're stupid. You're just saying, well, they're evil. And I try to just think, hey, maybe people who disagree with me, my starting point shouldn't be that they must be stupid or evil. I want to resist that thought and think, you know what? Maybe they just disagree with me. And
yeah,
I think with that, we can think, hey, you know what? Life has some shades of gray, or as we see in the map, maybe more purple than the red and blue.
Very important points, and something that we're going to continue to explore here. Dwight Keeley, he is a professor of law in the New Mexico State University Business College. Dwight, it's been great having you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, voters, along the political divide, also the topic of our In Focus interview this week. As you know, some analysts say that Democrats underperformed on election night, losing seats in the House and failing to capture the Senate. One of the Democratic losses was in New Mexico's 2nd Congressional District, where incumbent Xochitl Torres-Small lost to Republican Yvette Harrell. I talked with Torres-Small about the election, and we begin with the presidential race.
You know, there's a whole lot of work we need to do. As we continue to try to defeat COVID-19, it's going to be crucial that, of course, the election results are respected. That's a fundamental piece of our democracy. I lost, and I respect those results, and I think it's crucial that anyone putting themselves out for elected office respect the results of our democracy. And so now there is a lot of work that needs to be done, and even in these next 2 months, even before before President Biden-elect is sworn in, we're going to have so much work to do. Because right now, before January 20th, there are people who have lost their jobs. There are minors in Grant County who have lost their jobs and are now on the brink of losing their health care. We've got people in southeastern New Mexico, because of the decreased cost of oil, have lost their jobs. And there are family members and healthcare workers all across New Mexico who are struggling with COVID-19, who are seeing their relatives die because of this virus. And so in these next 2 months, it is going to be vital that we put together a COVID-19 package to have to support those folks going through these incredible challenges. And then once the Biden administration begins, there's going to be far more work to do to make sure that a vaccine is distributed, reaches people in their most vulnerable situations, reaches people even in rural areas. And so it's going to be crucial that we all identify that we've had an election, elections have results, and now we've got to work together.
Of course, President Trump is not accepting the results of the election. What do you make of that?
Well, like I said, that's part of what it means to be a republic, a representative democracy. And all of us have to accept the results of elections and move forward as Americans together.
Okay. You mentioned the COVID-19 relief. And since you mentioned it right now, we might as well talk about that briefly. As you know, House Speaker Pelosi came up with another plan that was pared down because Republicans in the Senate would not accept the original plan that was passed, said it was too expensive. But it doesn't look like the pared down plan is going to be accepted either. Mitch McConnell says we don't need a plan that big. What do you think needs to be done? And do you have any hope that anything can be done before the end of the year?
I do. And I think the effort to pare down is crucial, because both of those proposals were not able to achieve any bipartisan support, but there is opportunity for bipartisan support. I was part of the Problem Solvers, which is 25 Democrats, 25 Republicans, who put together a package that identifies the incredible common ground that we have. including investments in state, local, and tribal funds. As we know with the CARES Act package, local communities all across New Mexico were left out of immediate recovery. The only funds that went directly to a local community was to Albuquerque and Bernalillo County because of their population size. And so we've got to make sure we're getting money directly to those smaller governments, to places like Sunland Park, to places like Hobbs, to places like Grants and Milan, all across New Mexico and all across the country. And we've also got to make sure we're getting more money directly to Native American sovereign governments that right now are struggling incredibly with the challenges of COVID-19. Other areas of agreement that we have is making sure that we are supporting our robust agricultural economy. We've seen, I think in a way that a lot of people hadn't seen before, how crucial our supply chain for food is in the midst of COVID-19. And so being able to continue to support our dairy farmers, continue to support getting that those crops to market, some of the challenges that our chili farmers faced with labor recently, finding innovative ways to have their backs in the midst of COVID-19 is crucial. And that's why the Problem Solvers package included $25 billion in support for our ag economy. Another area of agreement is another wave of Paycheck Protection Program loans and quick relief for the loans that were already provided. Because you have small business owners all across New Mexico who really are the lifeblood of our main streets that are struggling because they're trying to continue to pay their employees when they have to shift to find new ways to reach their customers. And this really hit home to me. I was talking with the owner of a local distillery in Las Cruces, who's been incredibly innovative, working with NMSU to provide new products, working with Burrell Osteopathic Medicine to create hand sanitizer. So he's doing all he can, but he's worried about what next innovative steps he can take because he's got a big loan on his back, the Paycheck Protection loan that hasn't been forgiven yet. So we've got to forgive those loans so that those businesses can take those next steps to survive COVID-19, keep their doors open, and continue to employ their workers. So that's another area of compromise that we were able to reach through the Problem Solvers proposal. And then the last one is continued robust investments in supporting our healthcare infrastructure. That's getting tests all across the country. So it's not just in Albuquerque and Las Cruces, but no matter where in rural communities you are, you can get the COVID-19 test and being ready for dissemination of a vaccine. Because we've got some great news about the vaccine. Pfizer has developed, I think, something that has a very strong and a very effective rate, but it has to be distributed with super cold storage. And that creates a new challenge when it comes to reaching rural communities. And that's why we've got to make sure in the next COVID package that we're investing more support for healthcare and healthcare in rural places.
Okay, well, we will certainly be watching and wish you luck as you continue to work for the next couple of months on hopefully coming to some kind of compromise that can be put up for a vote in the U.S. Senate. I want to move to your campaign based on Albuquerque Journal polls. We thought that the race was really close, but as it turned out, your opponent, Yvette Harrell, had a win of about 8 points. How do you assess the results and how they happened, how this turned out this way?
You know, that's part of the beauty of a democracy, of a republic where you elect people to do this work. It's been an honor to get to do this job, and I'm grateful to be here in my official capacity talking about the continued job that I have to do for the next 2 months to make sure that we are continuing to move forward as part of our elections. And, you know, I'm proud of the job I've done. I'm incredibly grateful for and proud of the team that I've built, who's worked hard to build connections all across the district. And no matter what the results were, I'm proud of the people that we were able to deliver for. I'm proud of the lasting impact that we've seen, whether it's wilderness included in the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument, whether it is making White Sands National Monument, White Sands National Park, And in the midst of that, also strengthening the mission of White Sands Missile Range through the last year's National Defense Authorization Act, or whether it's something as simple as allowing doctors in grants to reach their patients by telephone in the midst of COVID-19 and get reimbursed so they can keep their clinic doors open. I'm proud of the work I've been able to do and grateful for the opportunity to have done it.
Of course, as you very well know, the work that you've done is part of the issue in terms of running for office. The other part is the actual campaign and how you communicate the message of the work that you've done. Looking at the results, and of course you may have access to internal polling and information that we don't, is there anything that you saw that you would do differently?
You know, what I know about our nation and our system of government is that decisions get made by the people who show up. And I was so proud to get to show up for my home for 2 years and do absolutely everything I could to show up in communities that did not expect to see me, to show up and have surprising conversations with people about the work that we could do together. And I also know that our democracy gets decided by the people who show up to vote. And no matter what polls are out there or what other information you may have, at the end of the day, it's about turnout. And we saw that this year in terms of who showed up to vote. And we will continue to see that for elections all across our future, is that the decisions will be made by the people who decide to show up.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure you've seen the many stories about other races around the country where Democrats were not reelected, and some have blamed progressive policies for this, the Green New Deal and policing reform, chief among them. Certainly ads that were placed in some cases by political action committees that were against your candidacy tried to associate you with environmental policies that you actually did not support. Do you think that that was a major impact?
You know, I'm not interested in a political blame game. I am grateful that I got to do this job, and I do want to make sure that as we take on challenges like climate change, which is an existential crisis, which will impact not future generations, but farmers and people in forests with the fear of forest fire right now, that we also find ways to include everyone in building the solution. And there are clear opportunities to do that. Things like the Use It Act, which invests in research for carbon capture sequestration, which will have to be a part of our solution when we combat climate change. Finding ways to support innovative solutions for capturing methane and making sure that we are using all of the methane that's being produced rather than letting it escape into the atmosphere or flaring it. We also can work with the oil and gas industry when it comes to use of produced water, recycling produced water to help address some of the challenges with water scarcity. And in the midst of that, and as we continue to build our robust energy economy, we should also be investing in solar and wind and making sure that we're investing in the transmission that's necessary to get that new energy to a market, which is currently one of the challenges that we face when we can continue to make New Mexico to diversify its energy portfolio.
Representative Xochitl Torres-Small. You can watch that entire interview tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV, or you'll find it anytime on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.